Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Tonight I'd like to give some teachings which the Buddha gave to the monastic community, but which are very relevant for all of us who are cultivating the spiritual life. And this teaching is about a way of producing protection for oneself, for creating a refuge for oneself. And in the normal way, when we consider the Buddha's teaching, we understand that the Buddha's always talking about an inner protector and an inner refuge, something that we have to cultivate within our own heart and mind. But in this teaching, the Buddha points out that the means to achieve that are very much rooted in our daily life and in the way that we live our daily life. And even though this teaching is to the monastic community, the first part of this teaching focuses on how the community of monks and nuns live together and how they relate to each other. And only later on does the Buddha talk about the cultivation of mindfulness and wisdom. I think this is a very important point for everyone to grasp, that even if we have the idea of living a spiritual life and that we need to cultivate the mind in meditation, for example, that's obviously an important part of this practice, it's also very important how we spend our time otherwise, and particularly how we relate to the people that we share our lives with. One of the things that we say is that we can't choose our relatives, we're stuck with them. And it's a bit like that in the monastic life. You don't choose the people that you're going to be living with. You might say, well, you can move away, you can go elsewhere, but particularly if you're a nun, there are very few places that you can go to. The monks have a little bit more of a choice, but you don't choose the people that you're going to be living with. And the people that you are going to live with are the people that you not only work with, but you are with together 24 hours a day. So it's even worse than being in a family, if you think about it in those terms, because at least if you're in the family, you can go to work and get away from them for a while and then come back home. But in the monastery, you're there together most of the time. And so how we relate to each other is very important. And that's why this teaching is a very practical teaching that is relevant for all of you as householders. Living together with family or living together with friends, or the way that you relate to the people at work, the people at school, all of these things are going to have a bearing on the quality of the mind, particularly the quality of the mind at the end of the day when you sit down to meditate. And so it's very important that you understand the connection, the cause and effect, relationship between how we spend our time and how we relate to the mundane aspects of life, the bearing that that will have on the meditation practice itself. Basically, what we're talking about in this teaching, when the Buddha's talking about creating a protector or a refuge, he's talking about creating the kind of life that we all want to live. To developing the qualities within ourselves that make us the kind of person that we'd like to live with. That when we wake up in the morning and we're with ourselves again, that we don't think, oh no, not another day. Because we can't get away from ourselves, even if we can get away from the other people that we're living with, the other people that we're working with, we can't get away from ourselves. And so when we're talking about creating a protector or a refuge, we're talking about creating the kind of inner life that makes us good company, good to be with for ourselves. Now, the first part of this teaching, the Buddha gives to the importance of living up to one's commitments. And in this teaching for the monastic community, the Buddha emphasizes the importance of what's called sila in Pali, virtue, and reminds the monastic community that all of you have voluntarily undertaken to live in a certain way, to live according to a certain set of rules, and to live in the monastery that has a particular way of doing things, a particular lifestyle. And having voluntarily taken that up, then live up to the commitments that you've undertaken. Keep up the standards that you said that you've set yourself. Live up to your aspirations. And this is very relevant for householders, for lay people living particularly in close relationships, whether it's parents with children, whether it's partners, husbands, wives, whether it's close relationships with friends. This idea of living up to the commitments that we've made, living up to what we say is important to us, the things that we say we value, the way that we say that we're going to live our life, the way that we want our life to be, to live up to those standards. So in relationships, the things which are so important for establishing relationships and cementing them, attributes, qualities like honesty, trust, forgiveness, generosity, harmlessness, all of these qualities which are actually encapsulated in the five precepts, the five basic standards for behaviour which all lay Buddhists dedicate themselves to when they take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and they take up the five precepts. Now, these qualities aren't abstract ideals. They are lived out in the way that we relate to the people that we are sharing our life with, and particularly the people that we're closest to, the ones that are really affected by how we deal with them, the ones that are waiting for an act of kindness, who are happy just to see us, who delight in our company, the people that are very deeply affected when we do something which is hurtful. When we establish relationships, whether it's in family life, parents and children, children and parents, or in partnership, we're making a statement about this relationship, that we value this relationship, that we're making a commitment to this relationship. And although in families we can't choose our relations, as I said earlier, we're stuck with our relations, so let's make the best of it. And when we consider what family life gives us and how hurt we are when it doesn't provide us with the nourishment, the nurturing that we need, we realise how important it is that we live up to our commitments in these very important relationships. And so the Buddha is, first of all, encouraging the monastic community to live up to their commitments, not only to cement good relationships with each other, but to develop a feeling of inner confidence and inner respect, self-respect, so that one is someone who's living a whole life, a life which is the same on the inside as it is on the outside, the same in private as it is in public, the same in the relationships that we truly value very closely, and which in the relationships with the wider circle of people that we share our life with. If we can't maintain honesty, trust, care in those closest relationships, then it's going to be more and more difficult to have those kinds of relationships with anyone. So we have to work at getting it right in the really important parts of our life. Not only for harmony with others, but for our own inner peace. How much inner stress, how much inner tension arises when we don't live according to how we say we live. When we're keeping parts of ourself separate from how we say we want to live our life, or what we say is important in our life. This is a very fundamental beginning for this spiritual life, this sense of inner confidence and self-respect. The next aspect, the Buddha said, is to reflect on why it is that we have been drawn to a spiritual path. And in this teaching to the monastic community, the Buddha says it's so important that we continually reflect on this reason. Why did we come into the monastery? What is it that's brought us to take up this commitment in the first place? What is it in the teaching that attracted us? What questions did we have that were unanswered? What was there missing in our life that made us look for something and then be prepared to take that dramatic step out of the familiar, the household life, into the monastic life? Now again, this is something which is just as relevant for lay practitioners. We need to keep reminding ourselves where we're coming from. What's the motivation for seeking guidance through the Buddha's teachings? What are the questions that we haven't been able to find answers for up until now in our life? It's important that we do this so that we are willing to open to the whole of the teaching and not just pick and choose those parts of it that appeal to us or that coincide with what we already believe. That we're willing to take up some of the teachings and try them out, even if they seem difficult, even if they seem to stretch us, even if they ask of us more than we expected to have to give when we had the ideal of becoming more spiritual learning to live more peacefully, being able to meditate well, whatever it is that we think we're going to get out of the spiritual life. When we consider just the five precepts, we might have thought that we'd be able to meditate and still go out dancing every night. Maybe we can still go out dancing every night, but we might have to start to limit what else we do when we go out dancing, or how much time we put into that part of our life if we want to keep our mind relatively peaceful and ready for meditation. We might find that we're challenged in our speech, for example. We might have been quite flippant in our speech, always ready to have a go at someone or make a wisecrack at someone's expense, or maybe stretch the truth a bit when it was convenient. And when we take up the five precepts, we are encouraged to speak only what is necessary, only what is kind, only what is truthful. And we might think, well, you know, what bearing does that have on meditation? But when we sit down to meditate, and the longer we practice, the more we are troubled by what we've said during the day, what we've done during the day, the more those thoughts about the speech come up and invade the mind and make it difficult for the mind to settle down. And we start to see the connection between right speech and a peaceful mind. Listening to the teaching is often going to challenge us to look at things differently. And it's right that we should investigate the teaching, not just take it as the truth because we've heard it from the teachers, heard that the Buddha said that. So the teaching on karma, for example, on getting back what we give out, that might be something which we don't like the sounds of because we seem to be getting back not what we're giving out. But then when we stop and have a look, even in the area of speech, for example, when we see how mindlessly we've been using speech, we can understand why out of the blue we seem to get someone telling us off or a nasty comment, or just being exposed to unpleasant speech, even if it's not directed to us. And we might start to recognise how somehow we're creating this kind of environment through the kind of speech that we've been using. And if we don't want that kind of environment, then we need to change our own behaviour. And so we experiment to see how we can do that. How do we practice that kind of restraint? What kind of new speech do I have to learn in order not to say what I used to say? And what effect does it have on my own peace of mind and also on the people around me? And what do I get back from it? This is the way we investigate the teaching, and this is what the Buddha encouraged all of us to do, to listen to the teaching, to question it, to remember it, to investigate it. And when we see that it works, when we see that it's the truth, even if it's difficult, to put it into practice. The next factor which the Buddha mentions as so important for helping us to keep up this kind of work is to have good friends. To keep company with those who are going in the same direction, who value the same things, who have the same aspirations that we do. And if we are taking up the spiritual life in earnest, then it may mean that we have to deliberately try to find friends like that. So coming together on a Friday night, coming together with others who are in the worldly life, coming from making a living, looking after families, but still making the effort to come together to try to practice meditation, making the effort to come together to hear the teachings, making the effort to come together to support each other in doing good. And when we come together like this, we're exposing ourselves to quite, a very high quality of people. People who are making the effort to do good, to be good, to live a good life. We can underestimate the power of that. We can take it for granted. We mightn't even like to think of ourselves as a do-gooder or a be-gooder. Might put us off if we think of ourselves in those terms. So use whatever label you like, but whatever perception you like, but just consider how we're going against the stream of the world by coming here and actively trying to purify the mind of greed, hatred and delusion. That's what we're doing when we sit in meditation and we try not to feed our likes and our dislikes. Just by not following the thoughts that come in, not following the planning and the scheming that take over the mind, just putting down the burden. Can we put down the burden? Sometimes no. We have to keep working at it again and again. We have to practice it. We have to keep producing the kind of conditions that make it possible to put down the burden. And that's what we do when we come here. We practice doing that. We come together with others who are also practicing doing it and who are finding how difficult it is. It's not something that we can just choose to do and do through willpower. We have to actually create the conditions for it. We have to guard the mind. We have to be careful with our speech. We have to change our behaviours. And then the mind can little by little put down the burden of thinking. And when we come together with other practitioners, we're encouraged because we see everyone's doing it, everyone's struggling, everyone's having to sit through the aches and pains. Everyone's having to face their demons, just like I am. And we're encouraged to keep doing it. And then not only that, when we come together in this kind of situation, there are all sorts of opportunities for actively cultivating wholesomeness by being helpful, by being kind, by being of service, helping in the library, giving someone a lift, talking to someone who's new to the centre, showing them around, starting to become familiar with the monastics, getting up the courage to go to the monastery and offer dana, becoming more familiar with the routine of things. All of these opportunities to cultivate what is wholesome. And that's what having good friends allows us to do. And especially when we are in the lay life and facing the challenges of lay life, the ups and downs, the disappointments, difficulties in the family, difficulties at work. When we have friends that we can call on, that we can turn to, who can listen to us and give us help, but who are doing it within the same kind of framework that we have. So, for example, when someone at work gives us a hard time, when someone at work maybe doesn't give us credit for something that we've thought up, the worldly advice might be, well, you better find some way of paying them back. You'd better find some way of getting even with them. That's the worldly way. And if we've got friends who have that kind of approach, we might find ourselves in a bit of a quandary. What's the best way to deal with this? And we might think, yeah, I better get back at them. But then we might think, hey, what about karma? What am I creating if I do the same to them? If I put that out into my workplace, if I use that kind of energy to get what I want? And we might find that we hesitate because we know that what's been said is the way to deal with this person contravenes what we've heard and what we've come to trust as the truth from listening to the teaching. So how do we cope in that situation? It's wonderful if we can go and speak to a Dharma friend and can explain the situation we're in and maybe recognize that what we would have done in the past is actually going to create more problems for us because we understand the law of cause and effect. And how then can we deal with this difficult person in our workplace? We may find that there's no simple solution. The strategies that we need to put in place might be something like changing our attitude to that person, trying to send them loving kindness. Hey, what? Send loving kindness to someone who's trying to put the knife in me? That sounds absolutely stupid. Only a Dharma friend would make that kind of recommendation. Well, it may take some time, it may take some practice, it may take some investigation to work out how we're going to put into practice the teaching that we've heard. Maybe, I can see the importance of practicing loving kindness because then at least I'll feel more relaxed and at ease myself. And when I practice loving kindness and the mind is at ease, then I can think more clearly. Maybe I don't have to think up an absolutely airtight solution to this problem. Maybe what I have to do is to be able to be more mindful and more relaxed, and then what I need to do will present itself to me when I'm faced with the situation. Maybe I have to play it by ear, but it has to be the Dharma ear and not the worldly ear. Now, unless we have friends who are practicing and who have put the teachings into practice and encountered the difficulties of doing that, when we face obstacles, when we face challenges, we're going to fall back on what's expedient. We're going to take what might seem the easy solution, but which actually leads us away from the truth. So having good friends is extremely important. And it's not enough just to expect good friends to be there when we need them. We have to be a good friend. And that's why every time we make the effort to come and support the centre, be present for meditation, we are supporting everyone else in having a place to come, a place where they can hear the teaching, a place where they can find good friends. Being a good friend is so important. And the Buddha said that in the holy life, in the monastic life, good friendship is the whole of the holy life. So it can't be overstated how important it is to cultivate friendships with those who are practicing and to be that kind of friend to those that we share our life with. What a blessing it is if children have parents who are using the Dharma as their frame of reference for life, their guidelines for life. And one of the things that parents can show through their own approach to life, one of the things they can show their children is that sometimes there isn't an easy solution to the challenges that we face. Sometimes there isn't a quick, easy fix answer to some of the difficulties that we face. We have to work through it step by step, but we work through it using the Dharma as our guide. And when we have good friends within our own family, whether we're good friends to our children or our good friends to our parents or good friends to our partners. What a blessing that is. The next quality that the Buddha talked about that cements relationships and makes it easy for people to live together is a willingness to learn new skills, develop new abilities, and to be willing to share that with especially the people that we live with. In the monastic life, there are certain things that we all have to learn to do, from the most basic things like sewing our robes to certain chanting and how to act as monastics, how to serve the seniors in the monastic community, how to deal with the things that are offered to us. All of those things are skills. And we have to use the material things of our life in a way that supports our practice of renunciation. And so there are particular ways of dealing with the things that are offered to us. And part of the monastic training is becoming familiar with all of those skills, all of the form, the way we do things. And being willing to teach others, being willing to show others how to do those things, and being willing to surrender to what is needed in the monastery when it's needed. Very often people have this image of monastics sitting on their cushion all day in meditation. But just like in the household life, there are lots of things that need to be done on a daily basis and regularly to keep a monastery running, to keep it maintained, to keep it growing, to make it the sort of peaceful place that visitors like to come to. And so part of the practice of renunciation in the monastery is being willing to give up one's time and energy to do what needs to be done, whether it's in terms of physical work or to look after the visitors who come or to look after the teachers who are dealing with the visitors who come. And the Buddha said, one who is willing to do that is practicing for their spiritual growth. Practicing at putting down self-centeredness. Instead of thinking that the monastery should serve me, we ask, how can I serve the monastery? Instead of thinking that the world should serve me, we think of, how can I serve others? And in family life, in our work situation, in our friendships, this is an approach that we need to cultivate. Not only to do good, but to be at peace. The fundamental cause of suffering, the Buddha said, is two-pronged: craving, self-centered desire, and ignorance, not understanding the way things really are. The expression of our ignorance is our self-centeredness. We think, if I get what I want, then I can be happy. And very often, doesn't matter about anyone else. We think that we live in isolation, that we can live just for ourselves and be fulfilled. And when we look around the world, when we look around at many people, we'll see them suffering under that delusion that they can be selfish, look after themselves first, and that they can be happy. But the nature of life and the nature of human beings is that we're all interconnected, that we affect each other, that we depend on each other, not only physically but emotionally. And so when we take the approach looking after me first and all the rest only later, we find that we're hurting ourselves. It's impossible. It's not possible for human beings to be completely self-centered and to be happy. And so the more that we can challenge that self-cherishing approach to life, the more we can open our heart and share ourselves with others, the more happiness arises from within. Now again, this is something which we need to investigate, not believe it just because we've heard that's what the Buddha said. Investigate what it's like when we try to take the last piece of cake and not let anyone else know that that's what we've done, when we've been selfish, when we've just done our washing and left everyone else's things in the basket, when we only wash our cup and don't wash up what's in the sink. We get away with doing the least, putting in the least effort, but we feel how we crinkle up inside with that trying to protect ourselves. Now, these are just small examples, but we know that in relationships, people go out and do all sorts of selfish things, thinking that they come first. I need this. Because I need this, I can do it even if it hurts you. We're very deluded sometimes in not seeing the connection between our happiness and our relationships with others. So the Buddha encourages us to open up, be willing to learn new things and share our skills, not just to get on better with others, but so we can be happy in ourselves, so that we can feel this self-respect, that we can feel ourselves connected, and in that connection feel ourselves much more complete. As well as being willing to share what we have, our time and energy particularly, the Buddha says that it's really important that we're willing to learn from others, that we're willing to be told. In the monastery, one of the things, the qualities that we're encouraged to develop is being easy to speak to. And I used to think that meant that I would be friendly and was able to talk to people and people could talk to me, that I was someone who was open. But in fact, it means much more than that. And this is the unpleasant part, at least it was for me, still is sometimes, is when people tell you what you don't want to hear, that you didn't do it very well, that they don't like what you did, that they wish you could do it differently, they wish you could be differently. To take admonishment means, is what to be easy to speak to really means. And in the monastic life, we open ourselves up regularly to admonishment from others in the community and also to our teachers. There's a particular procedure that we go through every fortnight where we have to confess the things that we've done wrong, the things that were against the training rules when we haven't lived up to the standards that we set ourselves. Or when we realise that we haven't done something as well as we could have. And this can be a painful process, this willingness to be admonished by others, to admit our shortcomings. But again, in relationships, in family relationships, partners, even in work relationships, that willingness to be corrected is something which we need to cultivate because it's part of the spiritual path. One of the aspects of wrong view is the sense of self, where we set up a very rigid idea of who we are, of the kind of person we are, of what we can and can't do, what we will and won't tolerate. This rigid sense of me, And we have to work so hard to protect that me when we don't do something as well as me does it. How do we cope? Do we cover up? Do we pretend we didn't notice? Do we hope no one else noticed? Do we feel guilty forever because we didn't live up to the idea of me? This very rigid, inflexible idea of ourselves is based on delusion. The Buddha said that there is no unchanging me. All of it, our ideas, our behaviours, our understandings, all of these things are in a state of flux, are all subject to change. They're affected by causes and conditions. So we feel more embarrassed if we do something foolish when we're in company than if we do it when we're on our own. When we trip over in front of a whole lot of people, especially people we don't know, we can feel terribly embarrassed. If we trip over at home in front of the family, well, we might be able to have a laugh. If we trip over just on our own, we may not even think twice about it. This sense of self causes us so much suffering, and it's particularly rears its head in relation to how other people see us and how we want them to see us. And so this idea of being willing to admit our mistakes, to acknowledge our shortcomings, to be honest about the things that we haven't done as well as we could have, not to beat ourselves up, but to be more in touch with the way things really are, to let this rigid sense of self, this rigid boundary between ourselves and others, gradually dissipate. To be willing and able to take correction. This is part of our spiritual growth. Now, when we don't like it, when it's difficult, we observe our reactions. We notice what it feels like. We notice how we don't like it. We ask ourselves, is what they're saying correct? Is there something in it? Or is it rubbish? Maybe what they say isn't true. And that's okay too. We notice someone said something, but it's not true. When we have a much more flexible sense of who we are, we can acknowledge that, because we're not putting up the barriers of protection, of denial, of rescuing ourselves from a difficult situation. So this quality of being willing to be admonished, easy to speak to, the Buddha said, is also part of the spiritual practice. And even if we're not in the monastic life, this is something which we can cultivate in our relationships, especially with those who are closest to us. One of the interesting things to investigate is, who can I take correction from? Who will I listen to when they give me advice? And who do I refuse to listen to? Who do I always shut off? Who will I never think that they know better than I do? And even this can be interesting to investigate. This is the way that we keep our mind open, not only to the teaching, but to our experience of life. In this particular teaching, the Buddha goes on to outline several other factors, which I won't have time to mention in detail, but I'll just mention them in passing. Apart from the good friends and the willingness to learn new things and share what we know with others, the willingness to be corrected, the Buddha talks about developing contentment with what we have, the appreciation of what we have in our life, developing that perception rather than developing the perception of all the things we don't have that are missing that we want to get, developing contentment, so the mind can be content also in the meditation. Generating energy, perseverance, determination to keep going even when the going is rough. And this is why it's so important to keep asking ourselves, why am I doing this? What brought me to this life? What were the questions that I didn't have the answers for? What have I gained from this teaching so far? And even when it's difficult, that can help us, encourage us to keep going. Love of truth is the next quality. The enthusiasm for the teaching and the enthusiasm for the practice. And this is something that grows as we see that the teaching is the truth. The teaching is pointing us in the direction of the truth. That it's giving us ways of living at peace with ourselves and others. As we start to feel the benefits for ourselves, as we start to see the growth that's taking place in our own life, in our own mind, we want to know more, we want to go further, we want to understand more deeply the truth that the Buddha was pointing to. And so this enthusiasm for the teaching, this grows, and it needs to grow if we're going to continue to struggle with the challenges that the spiritual life throws up to us. After we've done all of these other things, the Buddha said, then we get into the direct development of the mind through cultivating mindfulness and wisdom. In the meditation this evening, I was encouraging you to develop that quality of mindfulness, that knowing function in the mind that knows the breath, that knows thinking, but doesn't get caught up in the thinking, doesn't add anything on to the experience, but simply knows it as an observer objectively. This is mindfulness, and we start to apply this quality of observation to the whole of our experience, to our thoughts, to our speech, to our actions, in the meditation and in our daily life. And as we're able to stand back more and more from our experience, we start to see the patterns in our experience. We start to see the underlying laws that govern our experience. We start to develop insight, wisdom. In order to get to that point, we have to support the mind with all of the other strategies, all of the other ingredients that the Buddha outlined in this particular teaching. This isn't a comprehensive outline of all the ingredients we need. It's pointing out and emphasizing some of the aspects. But these are aspects that are particularly relevant for living in relationship with others. And all of us live in relationship with others. And the way that we live in relationship with others cannot be divorced from the spiritual practices that we do. The way we live with people is part of the spiritual path. And so I encourage all of you to reflect on this in your own life and to take up the spiritual practices in earnest, wholeheartedly, because they will bring tremendous benefit to each one of us, but also to everyone with whom we share our lives. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions or comments that they'd like to make? I'll just, oh, sorry, yes. So the question is that if someone asks you to please teach me meditation, that you don't, that you talk about all these other things about being a decent human being first of all. I don't think it's an either or. I think when someone is asking about meditation, that when you explain to them what meditation involves, that it naturally includes all of these other aspects. It naturally includes the way that we live our life and the way we spend our time outside meditation. And so I don't think it's necessary to say it's either or, but if you're going to teach someone in a way that's going to be productive, then you would naturally include what one does with one's life outside the meditation time. Yes.
I was just interested, Ajahn, when you were talking about social admonishment in the monastic community, I was wondering if at that time whether there was any praise or appreciation reached out as well, or whether that's considered to be not so useful.
Uh-huh. The question is about in the monastic life when there's we take admonishment, is there also praise given, because is that also included? And yes, it is. Definitely monastics, like anyone else, appreciate to be acknowledged for the good that they've done, that they have made an effort, that they've improved, that they've they're practicing well in accordance with the form of the monastery and whatever. So definitely praise is part of that admonishment. Someone has sent a question with notice, not specifically to me but to whoever was giving the teaching tonight. It says, please share with us the Buddha's teachings about the quality of life, death and reincarnation. Well, that's a very big topic, but the quality of life is what I've been talking about, and one of the aspects of the teaching that I gave tonight in terms of being a protection or a refuge for ourselves, which we create in our own mind, is to protect ourselves from creating unwholesome, unskillful thought, speech and action, which brings harm to ourselves now and in the future, and that instead we create wholesome thought, speech and action, which brings happiness to ourselves now and in the future. And fruits of the actions that we do can arise immediately in this life, it's immediately in the next moment, immediately in sometime later in this life, and also in future lives. So in terms of quality of life, we are practicing not only for this life and this moment, but for future lives. And if we follow the teachings given tonight just in our ordinary life, we're creating the conditions for a very favourable rebirth. And in terms of the Buddha's teaching, we will be able to face our death with much more acceptance, much more peacefulness, much more equanimity, if we know that we've lived a good life. And the Buddha said, if we live a good life now and have peace of mind and good relationships with other people, then if there's no rebirth, we'll at least have had a happy life in this birth, and we'll face our death peacefully. And if there is rebirth, then we will be able to live happily now, face our death peacefully and also look forward to a favourable rebirth. So there are no losers in this path of practice, only winners. All right, that's a very good question. So the question is that someone has seen in the monastic form that we have a situation when we're separating for some time that we ask each other for forgiveness for anything that we've done intentionally or unintentionally by body, speech or mind which has harmed one or the other. Normally, students do that to the teacher and then the teacher does it to the students. So how can this be applied in ordinary life, in relationships? Forgiveness is one of those very important qualities that we need to cultivate. Again, like loving kindness, not for the other person's benefit, first of all, but for our own. If we're not able to forgive someone, then we harden a part of ourselves, and very often we kill off that part of ourselves because we have such negative reactions when we think about that person, when we think about that time, and we're actually harming ourselves. Depending on what has been done, depending on the conditions, the circumstances, it may take some time to work up to forgiveness. We may not be able to directly go and say to someone that we forgive them. We may not feel strong enough to do that. We don't know how they're going to react to us. They may be no longer around. They may have moved away. They may be dead, whatever. So we're not talking about what we give to the other person, first of all. We're talking about what we're able to develop in our own mind, in our own heart. So being able to let go of hurts and to forgive is for our own benefit. And the ways that we do this are many. We need to cultivate loving kindness and compassion, see that we're all suffering in this world because of our ignorance, because of our wrong understanding. We often do things which are hurtful, thinking that we're going to find happiness. We don't realise the effect that we have on others. If we're living a very selfish life, it may be news to us that our actions actually have ramifications for others, that others care about us enough, that when we do something stupid, they're hurt by it. So loving kindness, compassion, understanding, realising that we're all caught up, bound by our ignorance, these are ways of working up to forgiveness. Seeing how we ourselves are prone to making mistakes, don't get it right all the time, hurt others without meaning to, starting to be soft with ourselves, forgiving with ourselves, this is also another important part of being able to forgive others. It takes courage to be able to forgive ourselves and to forgive others. This is not a wimpy kind of attribute to have. It's actually one that comes from strength, not from weakness. And so it's again one of those which is really integral to our spiritual growth.